That was good. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Reuben Jeffs was raised in the LDS Church and even went to high school with Gordon B. Hinckley. Of course, Hinckley went on to become prophet of the LDS Church, while Jeffs went on to become prophet of the FLDS Church. Must have been a very interesting high school class, I can say that for sure. In our next conversation with Lindsay Hanson Park, she's the host of the Year of Polygamy podcast, we'll talk more about Reuben Jeffs' early upbringing and his dealings with people who went on to lead the LDS Church. Check out our conversation. Hey, I just wanted to mention one more thing. The Mormon News Report podcast is an awesome podcast, and they cover the week in Mormon news with a healthy dose of snark and commentary. Join Brant and Jenny every Monday to get caught up on all those news stories that you can stay up to date on the latest Mormon news. So check out Mormon News Report. It's a great podcast. Brant and Jenny are great friends. Now back to our conversation.
So the reason why I bring this up is this is how messy it is. Reuben Jeffs is a nice LDS boy. He went by Reuben Jennings as a little boy because he was a polygamist. He didn't know his father was a polygamist until he was 8 years old. And that's when he learns his name isn't actually Jennings, it's Jeffs. His dad was David Jeffs. And when he finds out, he's embarrassed by it. His dad's a polygamist, that's embarrassing. Like, that's not cool anymore. You don't want to have a polygamist dad. You want to be like the cool monogamist. So Reuben Jeffs really tries hard to join the church hierarchy. He's a prominent accountant. He's hanging out with all the families, the prominent families. He marries Hubie Brown's daughter. This is why I bring this up, because I think that his generation is an interesting time period. Reuben Jeffs went to school with Gordon B. Hinckley. They went to the same high school together. He served as mission with Cleon Skousen in England.
Wow.
He was running with these people. He was one of them. He was on the track. He married Zola Brown. And he got a little disaffected on his mission. He had a bad experience with his mission president in England. And when he came home and he married Zola, she was just like, you know, I know your dad's a polygamist and you have a tense relationship, but he's your dad and we need to invite him over for dinner. So they would invite David over for Sunday dinner. And he would bring over copies of what's called Truth Magazine. So I want to back up for a minute. Joseph Musser was another one of these guys of this generation who his father was the church historian for the church. The famous, you know, Musser that ran the church archives. Joseph Musser becomes disaffected. He's the one that sneaks out the endowment ceremony from his dad. And he starts a publication called Truth Magazine.
Sneaks it out like he copies some of the text of the ceremony? Is that what you're saying?
The old ceremony with the penalties and the oaths. He prints it in Truth Magazine. Truth Magazine was a magazine he started, which was sort of the new era or end sign for fundamentalists. Where, again, they're not incorporated. They're loose organizations of men who, some of them attend in secret their LDS church. Maybe they haven't been, you know, they didn't preemptively, like, excommunicate all polygamists when they got rid of the manifesto. They just, you know, said don't bring on any. Yeah, so those people could affiliate with both, and that's what they were doing. And then they would go into these meetings and have a higher law. And so Musser was printing these fundamentalist
kind
ideas.
Kind of like the word of wisdom. It wasn't by way of commandment, but now it is.
No, exactly like that. And in some ways, the LDS is way more strict and fundamentalist about the word of wisdom than fundamentalist groups are, because they take old interpretations, because they didn't have Heber J. Grant, who was an alcoholic, addicted to beer, and had his own axe to grind with that. But anyway, so they gather down there, and David Jeffs introduces Truth Magazine to Reuben Jeffs. He and Zola can't deny what the magazine is saying, what his dad is saying. It's there, it's in the history. They know the families, they know. But Zola is very, you know, obedient to what her dad's trying to do. She sees her dad fighting this struggle, this political struggle, this private struggle, this personal struggle with all of his Mormon polygamous friends. And she was like, yeah, but we just can't, you know, polygamy is called of God, but we can't right now. Well, Reuben decides, he has a revelation that his office secretary has to be his plural wife. Tells Zola about it. She says, no, we can't do that. Absolutely not. And she's heartbroken. He does some really, in my opinion, manipulative things, but you can read their divorce proceedings. He basically was so abusive, he would freeze her out. He would disappear for days if she denied, you know, if they would have an argument about it. She wouldn't know he was coming back. She had a new baby. And she talks about it, she files for divorce finally because he digs out his basement to make room for a plural wife without her consent. And she says in her divorce hearings that her milk dried up. She was nursing. She was so stressed from that. Her milk dried up. So she was divorced. He gets excommunicated. Now all of a sudden, he's not on the track to leadership. And from what I think about Ruland Jeffs is that was really important to him. He was really, really going to be one of those guys. He wanted to be one of those guys. And so when this happens, it's a shameful thing. Zola goes off to California, eventually marries an LDS guy, stays in the church, raises her two sons with Ruland in the church. Ruland goes down to Short Creek, and he joins what's called the Council of Friends. Now, it's just a bunch of dudes with some authority from the LDS church who try to, you know, instruct members of the community and people that live around them and come to them for advice on matters of this. Well, Ruland, he decides this isn't good enough. We need to be more organized. We need to be like them. There's actually a prominent fundamentalist theory right now, which is really sad in the FLDS, because they see their community as righteous until the Jeffs show up. And one of the conspiracies is that, this is bananas conspiracy, J. Reuben Clark calls Ruland Jeffs to go disrupt the priesthood. And it's his goal to break it up. It's, of course, there's no way to back that up. But Ruland Jeffs goes there and...
So Ruland Jeffs was LDS?
Of course.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was very LDS. Lived up in Salt Lake. The majority of fundamentalist leaders lived up in Salt Lake. They would go to Short Creek to do their business. But anyway, they start the Council of Friends. Ruland Jeffs says we need to have what's called the one-man rule. He wants to streamline it like the LDS. And people support him and some don't. And that's when they...
So the one-man rule says... Because previous to this, at least as I understand it, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but... the sealing power was quite distributed among, especially among polygamists. You know,
yeah.
If you could receive the sealing power, and then you could seal anybody,
yeah,
as long as you had this. Whereas Ruland wanted to say, no, we need to consolidate this back to the prophet, kind of like the LDS. The LDS will distribute the sealing power to people called as a sealer in the temple,
yeah,
ceremony, but. You know, that you can receive that and it's taken away.
He wants to consolidate authority. That is basically the function of what he was doing. So you have prominent Mormons. Israel Barlow, for example, he was a famous Mormon back in Nauvoo. His descendant, John Y. Barlow, is one of the main people that starts the Council of Friends. So now you have, just like we have in the LDS church where we have Hinckleys and McConkeys and all the names that everyone knows, fundamentalists have the same thing. The Barlows is one of them. The Mussers. From Joseph Musser, the Jessups, the Steets, these are prominent names. And now all of a sudden you have, and they had been living in these communities together for a long time, and now all of a sudden you have a Jeff show up, right? And he's a prominent guy, married to Hubie Brown's daughter, like he's kind of a big deal. So he carries the weight of institutional sort of, what's the word I want, like legitimacy. And so he's trying to streamline it, and so it causes a split in the Council of Friends, because what he's really asking is a radical thing. He's down there with them for a long time, and he's on this council, and he's gaining a lot of status. And now all of a sudden he's saying, listen, the church isn't just out of order. They're off their rocker. We need to start our own thing. Like, we keep waiting for them to be put in order. It's never going to happen. Let's do it this way. So there's a break-off. And that happens much later, that... So I'm getting ahead of myself. So Ruland Jeffs joins the council. He's part of it for a long time.
The Council of Friends, which holds this sealing power.
Yeah, and so there, for the most part, they had, before Ruland Jeffs, one of the leaders of the Council of Friends, over time, over the course of a few decades, the Council of Friends becomes more and more and more organized, because that's what Mormon men do when they get together. They're like talking about priesthood, who's got the hair, who's going to do this, who's going to do this, who's doing land, who's the bishop, right? They start to organize slowly over time. So you have a man named Uncle Roy, Leroy Johnson. They call their prophets Uncle in the FLDS. So Uncle Roy was running the community, and by and large, he is seen as a beloved figure. They all talk about this time period. We're talking the 50s, 60s, and 70s of they're all baking pies and they're having harvest festivals and they're just like, you know, women are wearing their little aprons and baking bread and, you know, it's just this sort of idyllic family, rural family life. And, but he was kind of the leader of the Council of Friends, right? When he dies, there's this power vacuum. This is when Ruland steps up and it causes a split. At this point, we're in the 1970s. Rulin is ready to incorporate. He starts a trust, and they call it the United Effort Plan, the UEP. It's the idea of, so one of the things that polygamists believe were lost when the church, with the manifesto, were some higher laws: Adam, God, plural marriage, law of consecration, all things in common. So that's a tenet of Mormon fundamentalism that's pretty prevalent. And so they started the UEP, which is a trust where people would deed their property, give their time, talents, eventually their wives and children, to this trust, right? But this time, that's when it starts. So the FLDS break off into, the council breaks off. From this council, you have a bunch of schisms, and we could get into this, but it's super complicated. You can listen to the podcast for this. Basically, the council breaks off into the Allred group, where we have Rulin Allred, who is different Rulin, not Rulin Jeffs, Rulin Allred, who is over the AUB, which is the sister wife show, you know, on TLC, the sister wives. They're from the AUB. I call them Pinterest polygamists, because they look like LDS people. They have the blonde hair and the cute blonde kids and like the matchy outfits and the vinyl walls and the chevron, you know, maxi skirts. Those are the AUB. And they followed Rulin Allred, who broke off from the council. He was down in the Mexican colonies. That's where the LeBarons break off of him, and the Petersons broke off of him, and the FLDS, the Centennial Park, breaks off of them, and the Nielsen-Naylor group breaks off of them. And so they just start fracturing and schism. But the FLDS gets the most traction because they're a consolidated group, and Rulin really consolidates power by, in the year 2000, he predicts that when the Olympics come to Salt Lake, that the end of the world is coming. This would have been, you have to understand at this time, it's a Y2K scare. Remember, like, mm-hmm. everyone, Mormons or non-Mormons, it didn't matter. People thought the world was going to end. So he really uses that momentum to sort of say, we need to gather. So you have stories of fundamentalists who'd been living for generations in Salt Lake City, millionaires, owning companies, like, just like the LDS Church has a lot of prominent businessmen, fundamentalism has the same thing. They're selling their businesses overnight. And, you know, Rulin says the end is coming here. Rack up your credit cards. Give it all to the church because it doesn't matter anymore. So they all meet at this park, you know, waiting for Jesus to come. They're all celebrating. They've all given away all their stuff and moved down there now. Jesus doesn't come. And Rulin, of course, does what every prophet does with a failed revelation. It's like, who among you? One of you screwed this up for us with your wickedness. And, of course, every person's like, oh, shoot, it was me. Like, I lusted after another woman today. Damn it, it's my fault. And so, of course, that's how they end up there. And then, you know, Rulin was really sick at this time. His son, Warren Jeffs, was very calculated and basically took over power from his father by isolating him as he was sick and taking power, and then the FLDS goes crazy. But the thing that people don't understand is FLDS weren't always these, like, you know, pioneer-wearing, child-marrying people. For the most part, I mean, Uncle Roy, before Rulin, there are stories of him marrying younger girls to older men, but that wasn't seen as normal. It was seen as special circumstances, usually. And sort of to fix problems, right? Like pregnant girls, or sometimes, unfortunately, a man that was molesting his daughter, his stepdaughter, and he was like, well, let's just seal him up. You know, bad, not great situations, but nothing like Warren Jeffs. Nothing like Warren Jeffs. And so a lot of the town, Jeffs is a bad name. They think that the Jeffs came in, they were outsiders from Salt Lake, and came in, corrupted this beautiful doctrine. And so now that Warren Jeffs is in prison, that whole community is falling apart, and you have people that are starting to restore the restoration. The Mormons were big on that. We're always trying to restore the restoration. And so there's a bunch of new prophets popping up, trying to restore it to those times. But in the meantime, all of those groups continue to fracture and schism and schism and schism. And historian Steve Shields, he has estimated there's over, that he could trace, over 487 expressions of, you know, extant groups of Mormonism from the original church. Because everybody thinks that they're the original church. LDS are like, we're the real Mormon church. No. No such thing. Like, Joseph Smith's church is unrecognizable to all of the traditions now because it's got this patina of so many generations on it. And so he traces over 487 expressions. And this doesn't count, like, there are so many, Rick, I can't tell you, like, my whole life is now consumed and overwhelmed with, like, new movements popping up every week, and it's usually, like, two guys and an altar.
It seems like I heard there was a new prophet at Sunstone.
There was. We were really lucky. I always say that prophets are a dime a dozen in my world now, and they are. Like, when a guy's like, I'm a prophet and I have authority. This is why, like, I love my Mormon church. I sustain the brethren as leaders of the LDS church, but, like, priesthood and authority, in my mind, it's just like little boys having a pissing match. That's what it feels like to me, because it's just like, oh, really, you're the one mighty and strong this time? Ooh, how exciting. I've never heard that before. there was a gentleman that announced that he was prophet, or not prophet, he was one mighty and strong, Sinstone, and his theology was actually really brilliant. Like, normally guys are like, hey, the Lord talked to me, said you're wrong, I'm right, get on board. Nobody listens. But this guy was really interesting. He had this whole beautiful theology about Adam and Eve and their metaphors, and Adam represents the corporate church, or the LDS church, and Eve was all the expressions. I can't remember. I'm mumbling his theology, but basically that all the groups are right, and that God needs them to all be gathered to, you know, raise up seed, and he's the guy. That's spoiler alert, they're always the guy. Or I was just down in Colorado City this last weekend, or a couple weekends ago, and there was this gentleman who, he was telling me the story about how I was in the room when Warren Jeffs said that he wasn't the prophet, but he knew who was.
There's a video of that on YouTube. I've seen it.
This happens all the time.
Because it's on the prison phone call. He's like, I am not a...
Well, according to this gentleman, Warren said it at the death of his father. And he said, I'm not the prophet, but I know who's going to be. And I knew where this was going, this gentleman. And I said, so did Warren just tell you who it was? And he was like, he did. And I said, okay, so he told you who the real prophet is? He's like, yeah. And I said, can you tell us who it is? And he was like, he said, careful. And I said, is it you? And he was like, it is. And I was like, I didn't see that coming. I didn't see it coming. Wow. I mean, Mormonism is so ripe for this. You can't teach boys from an early age that they're going to be a god someday and not have this happen when their whole world falls apart. It's actually really sad to me, because I love the FLDS community. I love them. We have so much in common. They are my people. And I've learned so much about my own religion being an outsider in their community. But man, the men struggle. Like, everyone feels bad for the women, right? They always think, oh, these poor women and victims. And it's not to say that women have had it easy by any, you know, any version of the story. But the women have resilience, because they were not taught that they were that special. They were interchangeable in this system, and they learned strategies of resiliency. The men are so fragile, and I think this about LDS men too. This is why I think LDS men have the hardest time with a faith crisis, because they're promised to be a god someday. I didn't have to lose that when I questioned my faith. I was never going to be a prophet. It wasn't on the table for me. So I just, like, I, you know, build up other narratives. But you have men down there who, especially of an older generation, who gave their whole lives to this. And one thing that's really sad is you have men that have two wives, and they're on their deathbed, and they're like, where's my third? I got to get a third, or I can't go to the celestial kingdom. I can't even get in the lower level of the celestial kingdom. And here I practice this hard thing.
So three, you need at least three to
get in. The FLDS, that's their interpretation of the three, within the three. And you can actually trace that back to Joseph Smith. I spent a long time trying to figure out where that doctrine came from. William Clayton had written a few things, and... here's the thing about fundamentalists. You might think that their ideas are crazy. These guys are people obsessed with paperwork, documentary history. So they will find a precedent for it. I mean, I give a presentation at Sunstone this year where everyone likes to say, you know, fundamentalism's fine, but, like, except for Warren Jeffs. He's a bad guy. Like, all his stuff is crazy. It's not Mormon at all. And I can trace all of his most pernicious, insane, insidious doctrines to texts that Joseph Smith said. Because Warren Jeffs knew his stuff. He was a man obsessed. In the temple in Texas where they seized his property, books and books and books of old Mormon documents, old journal discourses, old Smith texts. I mean, that's what fundamentalists do. They're just taking Mormonism to a logical conclusion that I think reflects, in my opinion, generations of men that haven't had a lot of care in their life. So they make God out to be a hard God, because that's how they understand love, you know. I think frontier Mormonism really screwed us all up to make us think that God was really, really a hard God. And that's why, you know, we make God in our own image all the time. And that's why I think that fundamentalist doctrine can be so pernicious. I think it's just a mirror of how these men view themselves. But you have whole generations of men. Like, I went down there and there was a man who made his own sheriff badge. He was walking around town as a deputized himself, and he was a sheriff. You have all these guys who are starting these movements and starting their own, trying to make sense of this terrible thing that happened to them, losing their whole worldview, and the only resources they have, they haven't been exposed to internet, they haven't been exposed to larger culture, their businesses were taken away from them. The only pattern they have for anything of value or worth is being a man of God in the priesthood. It's the only thing that redeems anyone ever. And so how do you deal with this collective shame of losing all that, except to maybe invent it within yourself? It's really interesting. And I think it's really sad. There are so many, the men in these communities struggle. They're, you know, Warren Jeffs is in prison. Most of his brothers have been captured. There's a power vacuum. None of us really know who's leading the church. We do know that FLDS are leaving. The majority of the town now, and the work that I do is rehabilitating the town, getting it to be a normal town. In the meanwhile, the faithful FLDS are consolidating in South Dakota and a few other areas in the United States. We can't figure out who's running it. We have some theories, but for the most part, they're flying blind and it's open to interpretation. So Warren Jeffs will give some bananas revelation in prison. He's been in solitary confinement for over a decade now, which you can imagine what that does to a human mind. And he's speaking in code and he's completely checked out, and he's writing revelations that they're meant to interpret. And so you have one of the things he did that was the most pernicious that I think has a theological precedent in Mormonism is the idea of family separation. So Brigham Young began experimenting with a doctrine where you could divorce a woman if her husband was being unrighteous and, you know, give her to a higher priesthood. And I think the intent was good. You know, if you had an abusive husband, an alcoholic husband, you gave these plural families to a more righteous man, a better life. But this was abused from its inception. You know, people started consolidating wives for power, taking wives from people. Warren really ramps this doctrine up, and he did what's called family separation. So the majority of FLDS people now, ex-FLDS or in the church, are not place with their original family members or biological siblings or parents. Warren has reassigned the families so many times. The trauma that has done on their families alone is a human rights violation to a degree that I don't think we can even understand. I mean, family belonging is such a core part of human identity, and Warren has just figured out a way to just obliterate all of that. And so he's separated. He's annulled all the marriages, so men and women aren't even allowed to be together sexually. So it's just super screwed up. So you have generations of men now who they've been cut off from the church. The church has asked them to repent. They still think that they're wicked. They still believe in Warren Jeffs. They think that they're the problem. And they're on these work missions and work crews all over the country. And God's not speaking to them because Warren isn't communicating. There's no leader to give them instruction to tell them they're back in. So they're just waiting. They're waiting for God to reveal it. And they're men in their 50s, 40s, 50s, never married, working day in, day out, and these work crews come home, don't even know what to do with themselves, completely lost. And it's just a tragedy. It's it's been a difficult thing for me to reconcile as I started this out to, you know, the history is fun and it's great and it's interesting, but this is also a legacy of Joseph Smith. And we are so insistent on separating Joseph from this. Well, it's not Joseph. These guys went rogue. They did the thing. Like, they're just taking it the wrong way. You know, they're the problem, and I don't think that that's right. I think we can't begin to help this people or our people until we're willing to, like, recognize that it's a system that we're all involved in, and we all had our part to play. And my part to play was, you know, marginalizing these people, telling myself stories about them to sort of not have to confront the reality of how their Mormonism, the light, the mirror that holds up to my own Mormonism, right? But to me, they're so tied in together. And if you look at this history, they have paperwork. You know, you can't deny that. It's crazy, but it's not more crazy than Joseph Smith getting this paperwork.
You don't agree with their paperwork.
I agree historically with their paperwork. I agree. I don't agree with their authority because I think Mormon authority is bananas. I mean, it just, like, there's no rhyme or reason for it. And that started with Brigham Young Joseph Smith had no plan. Because I think Joseph Smith didn't think he was going to go. And by the time he realized he was done for, there wasn't enough in place, right? And because of that, we have all of this Mormon authority. I think they have as good an argument as anyone else. That's what I think.
But you're not persuaded. I mean, I'm sure fundamentalists have come to you and said, "Well, why don't you want to become a sister wife?"
Oh, gosh, no. Am I going to practice plural marriage? No, to the disappointment of everyone that keeps trying. No, I've been proposed to many times. It's not my thing.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with polygamy expert and podcaster Lindsay Hansen Park. In our next conversation, Lindsay will share her opinion that she thinks the LDS Church made conditions ripe for Warren Jeffs, and the LDS Church deserves some culpability for what happened in that community.
Here's my indictment of the LDS people and the LDS Church. We are responsible for men like Warren Jeffs. I think we are complicit, at the very least, and at the very worst, responsible for men like that, because what we did is we allowed something to be so marginalized and to turn the other way because we didn't want to see how it reflected on us. We can't make the church look bad. We got to protect the integrity of the church. So we're going to ignore what's happening down there, and we're going to make it illegal. So Warren Jeffs can say, you know what, you're being molested by your father or your brother. You can't report it to the police, because if you do, your whole family's going to go to jail. We can't trust any outsiders, because even the LDS, like, they are out to get us.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available at either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com, and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript. And over here, we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.